Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Pleasure to be with you this evening. Have a chance to address ourselves to the subject, if God exists, why are there so many atheists? Some people have asked me why I wound up in theology after getting a doctorate in astrophysics. Have alleged perhaps that the job market had dried up in astrophysics, so I went over to theology where the pickings were better. Well, as far as I can tell, the pickings are not better in theology. I moved over to that area because I felt that as important as astrophysics is, that the whole matter of the existence of God, his nature, what man is like, and what we need to know about all these things is a matter of even greater importance. Our subject tonight, then, if God exists, why are there so many atheists, is, I think, a very fair question, and one we ought to attempt a fair answer to. Now, let you in on a secret here right at the beginning, and that is that I believe that biblical Christianity is true, and I will be operating from that perspective. I'm not going to try to answer the question, if the God of liberal theology exists, there are several different gods of that variety, but if the God of liberal theology exists, why are there so many atheists? For those who believe in such a God will have to answer that question. My subject here tonight, I'm going to try and answer from the perspective, if the God of biblical Christianity exists, why are there so many atheists? To start out, let's examine first the structure of the argument. Considering anything else, let's just look at the structure of the argument. There are a lot of other arguments that could be structured similarly. If a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit exists in the United States, why are there so many people that drive 65 or something like that? However, I would like to examine the structure of the argument briefly by looking at the reverse of the argument. If God doesn't exist, why are there so many theists? That's certainly a fair question to ask. Now, if you set those two arguments side by side, you find that the structure of them is identical. If God exists, why are there so many atheists? If God doesn't exist, why are there so many theists? In fact, then, if you tried to count noses or hands or whatever you were counting, you would probably find out that there are more theists than there are atheists. And even if you narrowed it down to those theists who believe in the God of biblical Christianity, I think it's fairly safe to say that there are more people who believe in biblical Christianity than there are who believe and the non-existence of God. So if you just said, well, the argument is going to be settled by a show of hands, I'm talking about a show of hands here tonight, you would at least have to say that the stronger side of the argument would appear to be on the side of biblical theism. However, I'm not going to try and do it from that direction. Just trying to see a little bit about the structure. Now, an atheist will normally say, well, yes, of course, there are more people who believe in the God of the Bible than there are people who don't believe in God at all. But that's because Christians are engaged in wishful thinking. You know, the truth is too bad to contemplate, and therefore people have to invent something to make it better. And so Christians are just those who are engaged in wishful thinking, whereas we atheists are stern realists, and we're not afraid to look at the facts as they are. We're not afraid to face the universe as bad as it may be, without a God, without meaning, and such. Now, that may sound rather impressive at first, except it is not directed against the God of biblical Christianity. It is directed against a God of liberal theology. A person might very well think that they have faced the universe, find it too hard to believe in no God, and therefore choose to believe in the God of liberal theology. But if you're going to really look and see who, on straightforward look at the thing, seems to be doing wishful thinking, and you're looking at the two groups, those who believe in the God of the Bible and those who believe in no God, I think you'd have to say the evidence would suggest that it's the atheists who are doing the wishful thinking. After all, the God of the Bible is pictured as a God who hates sin and who is going to bring every man's action and thought into judgment. And there is going to be a punishment for unrighteousness that will last forever. A terrible picture. Now, certainly, an atheist would not like to see that. And therefore, one can reasonably argue that perhaps the atheists are engaged in wishful thinking, wishing that there be no God. Now, to look at it from the other side, I don't see any easy reason why theists, those who believe in a God, would invent the God of biblical Christianity. Let's notice something. The God of the Bible doesn't need anything from us. That's seen throughout the Bible. And therefore, there's nothing we can do to earn his favor. Now, if I was going to invent a God, I would invent a God that I could do favors for, so I could get on his right side. But the God of the Bible doesn't need a thing, and there's nothing you can do to earn his favor. And therefore, that's a rather unlikely thing to invent such a God. Besides that, the God of the Bible sees the most righteous men and women as wicked, as sinners, and as every person deserving punishment. Now, if I were going to invent a God, I would not invent a God that believes that the most righteous person, or even me, is a wicked person deserving punishment. I don't like people who think that way about me. If I were going to invent a God, I'd invent a God that's much more pleasant than that. Besides that, the God of the Bible looks at those who know him better, those who study his word and spend time thinking about him. He holds them far more responsible for their actions than those who've never heard of him. And he's going to judge them by far more stringent standard than those who've never heard of him. So if I were going to invent a God, I certainly wouldn't invent a God to do it that way. I would invent a God that I'd be on his side if I believed in him and studied his word, etc. There wouldn't be any problem in that direction. Besides that, the God of the Bible will forgive the most dissolute person who truly repents and turns back to him and admits his guilt and casts himself upon God's mercy. But he will condemn the most righteous person who thinks he's okay. If I were going to invent a God, I certainly wouldn't invent a God like that. So I'd have to say, when you just look at the God of biblical Christianity, it doesn't look like the kind of God a person would invent if they were involved in wishful thinking. Whereas if you look at atheism, atheists certainly have a very strong gut reaction anytime they hear about the God of biblical Christianity. And it rather strongly suggests that if anybody's engaged in wishful thinking, they might very well be. Now, I'll have to admit that our gut reactions and psychologizing about why people may or may not believe various things may not be terribly profitable, because we can invent great psychological reasons why somebody did something and be drastically wrong, because we don't know why they really did them. So basically what I'm trying to show you here is that by the structure of the argument, by headcount, if we look at if God exists, why are there so many atheists? If God doesn't exist, why are there so many theists? You would have to say, if anything, it will come down on the side of theism. If you're interested in looking at some of these other areas relating to psychologizing, relating to the problems atheists have with trying to explain away Christianity as wish fulfillment, I'd suggest you have a look at two rather interesting books, one by C.S. Lewis called Pilgrim's Regress. It's interesting for many different reasons, but one of them is in this whole dealing with the matter of wishful thinking, psychologizing. The other one is a book by a fellow named R.C. Sproul, and it's called The Psychology of Atheism. Both of those would be worthwhile looking at in the whole question of the structure of this type of argument. Let us return, however, to the argument itself, and now begin to look at its content and ask ourselves if, for the God of the Bible would give any reasons why atheists, few or many, should exist. Is it true that an argument, if God exists, or if the God of the Bible exists, why are there so many atheists? Is it true that such an argument has force? That is it true that if you take the system of teaching that the Bible gives, that it would predict that there'd be no atheists? And therefore, the existence of atheists is a strong argument against the existence of the God of the Bible. Well, in fact, there are two rather important features of the Bible which suggest very strongly that we should expect to find atheists lurking around. The first of these I call the silence of God. The silence of God. Now, by this I do not mean that God has made no attempt to make himself known. Indeed, the Bible is very clear that the universe itself gives us evidence for the existence of a God, that certain features inside our own personality give us evidence for the existence of God, that there are other features in the structure of Scripture and in certain things the Scripture says about what's going to happen, which then happens, certain features relating to historical studies of the time of Jesus Christ, historical studies related to the time of Moses, that suggest very much that indeed there is a God who is intervening in history. What I mean here is that the Bible pictures God as being relatively hidden because he does not continually intervene in his universe. God is relatively hidden because he's not continually intervening in his universe. The Bible does not suggest, contrary to what some people may think, that miracles are going on all the time. The Bible does not suggest that if God exists, you ought to be able to make a prayer and immediately get some spectacular answer that could have no other interpretation whatever, and therefore anybody with any sense at all ought to be aware that God exists. Rather, the Bible speaks of the silence of God. This is seen probably as clearly as anywhere in the 50th Psalm. Let me read you a little bit of it. The Mighty One, God, the Lord, will speak, and he will summon the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God will shine forth. Our God will come and not keep silence. A fire will devour before him. It will be very tempestuous round about him. He will summon the heavens above and the earth to judge his people. Gather my godly ones to me, he says, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice, and the heavens will declare his righteousness, for God himself will be judge. We see a picture here of a judgment day that is coming, and in the midst of the description of this judgment day, we are told God will not keep silence. There's a picture that he has been keeping silence in some sense before that time, but then he is going to break into history in a quite unmistakable way. So here's a picture that shows us that because God is not continually intervening in his universe in an unmistakable way, it is possible for us to somehow ignore God's existence or to misinterpret his nature. The result of this will be that it is possible for a person to be relatively sincere and still be drastically wrong about the question, say, of the existence of God, or the question of what kind of shape we're in, or what you need to do to find out about God and get things straightened out. The Bible speaks of this in several places. Probably the commonest passage that gives us this picture is found twice in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 14:12 and 16:25. There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end of it are the ways of death. We see a picture here that a person may think a certain course of action is right, but has disastrous consequences. Now, in fact, we know that that's true in certain aspects of our universe. A person may think that a certain door leads out onto a porch, second floor, and it turns out the porch has been removed because it was falling down, and the person opens the door in the dark, steps out, finds no porch, and finds something else very quickly. That can happen, and though it's somewhat humorous, it certainly wouldn't be humorous if you did it, a person can take what he thinks is aspirin, and it turns out to be something quite different, and they kill themselves. Those things happen. We live in a dangerous universe, a universe in which a person can be relatively sincere and yet drastically wrong. The Bible pictures the same situation here. Now, I've said 4 or 5 times already, relatively sincere. I don't say absolutely sincere, because nobody's absolutely sincere. All of us, when we look at our motivations, we find there are things wrong with them and there are things right with them, and so none of us is absolutely sincere. But I'm just saying a person may be relatively sincere, but drastically wrong, and therefore perhaps a person could not believe in the existence of God on what seemed to him to be reasonable bases, and yet in fact God exists, and he's in bad shape when the time comes. Now you might ask, why on earth would God possibly set up a universe in which his existence is not absolutely as obvious as it possibly could be? I think we'd have to admit we believe what the Bible teaches, that God has not made the universe so that his existence is absolutely as obvious as it possibly could be. Well, the Bible gives several reasons in that direction. We find one of them in the first chapter of the book of Romans. Don't know whether I'll read all of that. I'll read all of this. Romans chapter 1, verses 21 through 32. Let me back up and pick up a few verses earlier. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, and clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. But even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, their foolish heart was darkened, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, worshipped and served the creature, rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. The same way also the men abandoned the natural function of the women, burned in their desire towards one another, men with men, committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They're gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but they give hearty approval to those who practice them. The first reason I suggest here that God might not make his existence as obvious as it could possibly be is to give a chance to demonstrate in history the true character of sin. If God, every time a person stepped out of line, zapped him, we would probably run out of people very quickly. But ignoring that, it would not be possible to find out what is really wrong with sin. You'd only find out that God doesn't like it. But if you can allow sin to work itself out in a society, to work itself out in a family, to work itself out in an individual's life, then it will begin to become apparent how it ruins relationships, how it ruins a personality, how in fact it makes life terribly unpleasant. And a person begins to get an idea of how bad sin is. That idea could never be gained, at least in the experiential way, if God did not back off enough to let people sin and, quote, get away with it. They don't get away with it in one sense. It has natural outworkings, which there's no way to escape. But they do get away with it in the sense that God does not immediately zap them. There's another point here, I think, rather closely related that we can see in this matter. Let me look at two passages that have to do with this. Why should God not make his existence as obvious as he possibly could? One of these, I think, is seen in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Here we have a picture that a person will not do certain things if he knows he's going to get punished for it immediately. But if he doesn't get punished for it, he will do it. He may only just do a little. And then if he doesn't get punished for that, he'll do a little more. If he doesn't get punished for that, he'll do a little more. In fact, this is a problem in child raising. Trying to know where to step in and cut off something so that you preserve the person's freedom and ability to grow up as a person who makes their own decisions, and yet on the other hand, not to turn out with a monster who will be killed by the state before he's 30 years old if he doesn't get killed by somebody of a more unofficial sort before then. But the picture here is you are really allowing room for genuine moral behavior. Behavior of somebody is not really particularly moral if the only reason they do things is they know that if they don't do them, they're going to get whacked immediately. So a child may behave rather nicely when the father's around who is good at whacking, but when he goes to work and the mother is only around and she doesn't believe in that, the kid may suddenly convert from an angel to a monster. Well, he was that way all along, if you like, but he was under a certain amount of restraint at the one point, and now the restraint breaks loose. We see the same picture in Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 1 through 3, though perhaps it comes at it from a slightly different direction. Deuteronomy 13, God is picturing a situation which existed during Israel's history in which spokesmen for God would come along now and then, called prophets, and they needed to give some evidence that they were really from God. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, and now we get his theology, let us go after other gods whom you've not known, and let us serve them, You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Here's something. God set up an arrangement by which prophets were to come in Israel, and yet he said, there's occasionally going to come false prophets along, and some of them are going to be able to do miracles. I'm not going to intervene to stop them from being able to do miracles in general. I might occasionally. I'm not going to do it in general, because I want to see whether you follow me because you love me, or whether you merely follow me because I've got the best I've got the prophets who can turn out the food or something like that. So here again, we see a place left by God to give room for genuine moral behavior, a room for a person's love even when things aren't going right. Well, of course, if you don't have a universe in which anything seems to go wrong, there's no room for a person struggling against difficulties. He just rides with a stream. Of course, you like God because everything goes right when you do it with his way or something like that. No, it's not that simple. God has backed off to leave room for real moral behavior. There's a third reason why God backs off, if you like. Not only does he do it to demonstrate the true character of sin, not only does he do it to give room for genuine moral behavior, but he also does it to leave men room for repentance, to cause them, in fact, to turn back to him. This is seen many places. One example certainly would be in Romans chapter 2, verse 4. Do you think lightly of the riches of his kindness, talking about God, and forbearance and patience, not knowing that the kindness of God leads you to repentance? Picture here is that God does not immediately intervene because he wants to give a chance for a person to turn back to him. And a person cannot turn back to him if he has been destroyed by God's judgment. A person may have an opportunity by seeing where things go in his own life, from bad to worse, say, something's wrong, I need to get things turned around. Let's see what I can do. Maybe I need to re-examine my whole lifestyle. Maybe I need to re-examine my whole philosophy. Well, these three suggestions then give us this result. According to the Bible, God has reasons for not making his existence as clear as he might. According to the Bible, God has reasons for not making his existence as clear as he might possibly do. So, if we believe, if we are asking the question, if God exists, why are there so many atheists? A person would say, if the God of the Bible exists, we should not be surprised that there might be atheists, because God does not make his existence as clear as he might possibly do. But there's another very important reason why God might exist, and yet there be many atheists, and that is the sinfulness of man. In Romans chapter 1, I've already read the passage, but I'll read it to you again. The anger, the wrath of God, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. The Bible says that men are not playing fair methodologically with the evidence. They don't want it to come out a certain way, and therefore they are bending certain things if necessary to avoid coming to that conclusion. Now, we may at first have a hard time believing that, though if we examine our own attitudes occasionally, and if we examine the attitudes of others, sometimes it's tough to examine the attitudes of others, we can't see inside of them, that may become clear. I remember in a work by Sir Fred Hoyle, rather famous astrophysicist, cosmologist, a work that came out in 1965 called Galaxies, Nuclei, and Quasars, that he said, I don't spend any time investigating cosmologies for a universe that has a beginning. It's one of my shortcuts, he says. I don't waste time investigating a models of a universe that have a beginning. He's ruled them out already. Does not examine the evidence, doesn't investigate them. Well, he does not produce any evidence why such a universe cannot be. So, in fact, he writes his books as though something else is true, though, in fact, the situation, he does not spend any time investigating this whole line of endeavor. We see also a good picture of the same sort of thing in Huxley's work, Ends and Means. There, Huxley tells us that he has adopted the view that the universe is meaningless because that gives him an ability to do what he wants in the universe. If he adopted the view that the universe had some meaning for God, then he would be restricted in his behavior. He does not want to be restricted in his behavior, therefore he does not adopt that kind of view, and yet he is a major propagandist for a view that there is no God. There are some excellent examples of the same thing in the area of astrophysics, in the area of cosmology, in a recent work by Robert Jastrow. Jastrow is a professor at Dartmouth University, Columbia University. He is founder of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York City, has written a work recently, fairly popular work, God and the Astronomers. And there are a number of rather juicy quotations in there of how men do not like the idea that the universe had a beginning, though in fact the data points in that direction. And I would refer you to his material to see this same sort of thing. Well, one problem then is, because of the sinfulness of men, men want to avoid certain types of conclusions, and they will do it by manipulating the data. Men suppress truth. There's a second item we might note under the sinfulness of man, and that is some men are deceived by other men. A person who is in biology or in history or something like that does not have time to examine the data of astrophysics. And so when he reads something by Fred Hoyle that says the universe has always existed, it's in a steady state, and things of this variety, says, well, that fellow ought to know. He studied it his whole lifetime. He's a world-renowned figure. I'll take his word for it, and I will use that when I do my investigations in my own area. You see, the problem of modern specialization is such that no one of us can really thoroughly examine the data in more than maybe one or two fields. And so we really don't know what the data looks like in more than one or two fields. So we have to take somebody else's word for that. These other areas, yet those other areas are important. If we've taken the wrong person's word, we may have made a very, very serious mistake. The sinfulness of man, then, brings us another element in regard to this matter. According to the Bible, men have reasons for making the evidence for the existence of God less obvious than it really is. So, when we back up and ask the question, if God exists, why are there so many atheists? The Bible would say, if the God of the Bible exists, and mankind is as he is described in the Bible, then we should expect many atheists. Because we have God leaving room for moral behavior, stepping back, allowing men room to more or less do what they want, with the consequence, of course. And we have men not wanting the kind of God that's pictured in the Bible, and therefore being willing to use slightly different methodologies in theology than they use in history or some other area. And we have men who are specialists in one area, giving as assured results what are in fact a presupposition, and then using that presupposition to mold the data, and another person looks at it as an assured result, and he applies that in his field. He has been deceived by the work of another person who is not able to recheck in great detail. So far, we have looked at the question, if God exists, why are there so many atheists? And we've suggested that if the God of the Bible exists, and if man is pictured, is as pictured in the Bible, then we would expect that there would be atheists, and it would be tough to tell how many to expect there would be. So far, however, we have not considered the question of whether or not God exists, but only whether or not that argument has any force. And the suggestion here is that argument, if God exists, why are there so many atheists, has no force for the Bible. May have excellent force for the God of theological liberalism. Might have force for the God of Islam, has no force for the God of the Bible. But I don't think it would be fair for us to leave it as kind of a flip a coin and take your choice. Comes down heads, theist. Tails, atheist. No. My studies, I don't claim to have studied everything, by the way, I've studied a fair amount of data in recent years, is that there is more evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible than there is for the existence of any other God, and there's more existence for the God of the Bible than there is for the non-existence of God. I'd like to look briefly, fairly briefly, at evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible. A rather important line of evidence in this direction, I think, is design in nature. I do not mean necessarily the existence of natural law, although no satisfactory suggestions have been given for why natural law should necessarily be of a permanent existence or something of that sort. What I mean is something else. Let's look briefly at the organization of the simplest life that exists. I'm not a biologist. I have not even had too much biology. But a fellow from this institution, Carl Sagan, has written an article in Encyclopedia Britannica entitled Life. In that, he attempts to give us a brief picture of how complicated the simplest living organisms are. He takes the simplest viable cell rather than a virus of some sort, because a virus has a slight problem that it will not function without life. So whatever it might have been before that time or all of that in various theories does not cut much ice here. You've got to operate on what life actually exists. The simplest living cell, says Sagan, has a very complicated structure to it, which is coded in the DNA that exists in the nucleus of the cell. He estimates the information equivalent of that DNA stored in the cell in terms of bits of computer information. And I converted that over, well, he converted it partially into pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I converted the pages into sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica to get the information content of the simplest living cell and write it out in computer language. It would take 4,000 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. 25 volumes, about 1,000 pages per volume, 4,000 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, we are told by those who do not believe in the existence of God that somehow the rather low level of information that exists in the inorganic chemical sphere has been converted to the information equivalent of 4,000 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica by random processes. That is a large amount of information to convert, to produce by a random process. And the person may say, well, given enough time, a random process will produce any amount of information. That, I think, can be debated because it's not merely a problem of producing it. It's a problem of killing off all the competitors and having it sitting there as what exists. But let's imagine a very simple experiment, thought experiment. You can try and do this sometime if you'd like, but a very simple thought experiment. Imagine that you have very simple electric typewriters. They're designed so that they have no upper and lower case, merely caps, okay? And they're designed so they've only got 33 keys, which is about 11 less than an average electric typewriter. They've got all the alphabet, a space, and a few pieces of punctuation. Bring in any number of trained monkeys and ask them how, I mean, don't ask them. Okay. See how long it will take them to type 4,000 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. We're not going to do that, though. That's a complicated, large number. Do a simple one. Set them all down at their typewriters. How long will it take to type out the title Encyclopedia Britannica? All caps, P-A-E-D-I-A, and the space between the A and the B, the end of Encyclopedia and the beginning of Britannica. Imagine they type at 3 characters per second. Not too fast for a typist, but pretty good for a monkey. And imagine none of the typewriters clunk down, anything of that sort. Well, you can work it out. You can fix any number of monkeys and ask how long it would take. But we worked it out instead in monkey years. You build a building, you say, that's going to take 75,000 man hours to build this building. Well, how many monkey years would it take to do this project? Well, you can do it rather easily then with three strokes per second and 33 keys on the typewriter and such. It turns out that it would take 100,000 billion billion monkey years to type those 2 words. But then somebody's got to find it. You know, we'll go through all the reams. You say, okay, we've done it that long. There's a 50-50 chance that these 2 words are somewhere in this, and all this paper scattered all over the room where you've got your monkeys. Now you need to send somebody, but have to send an intelligence to find it. You still have a problem in that direction. All of this is not to suggest that monkeys type at the same speed that molecules combine or anything of that sort. It's just to give you a very quick visual impression of how little complexity exists in the two words Encyclopedia Britannica, but how much random effort is necessary to produce it. The problem then we face in saying that the life that exists in the universe, a universe which, by virtually anybody's scheme, is not usable for living things over a period of more than about 8 or 10 billion years, because the suns run through their cycle too far and mess things up, or the universe bangs or something of that variety, there would seem to be no chance of producing the complexity that we've got in life. The minimum thing you'd have to say is this. The biblical picture is that order in the universe is the result of a mind. We happen to know that minds can produce order. We do it every day. We may produce a fair amount of disorder or leave a fair amount of disorder around, but minds can produce order. The biblical view is that God has a mind. Our mind is a small-scale model of God's mind. Therefore, we have a model in the biblical position for the existence of order. No one has yet been able to show how a random process can produce anything within orders of magnitude of the kind of order we've got in the universe. So it's not a toss-up. You know, the idea that the universe just happened, the idea that the organization in the universe just happened, is an equally good model with the idea that a mind put it together, because we've got a model for how minds put order together, and they can do it very easily. And no one has been able to show by a computer, after all, you can model this on a computer, you can have a computer run random things and see what kind of order you can get out of it. Nobody's been able to model on a computer the kind of order, any level of order to speak of. Nothing like the kind of order we actually need. So here, I think, is a very serious problem for the claim that God does not exist. But an excellent evidence that a God of the sort of the Bible does exist. It, of course, does not narrow it down to the God of the Bible. This is one point. It would suggest a God who has the kind of structure we have to be able to take disorganized things and organize them would exist. Let's look at another line of evidence for the existence of God, and that's the area of cosmology. I've said a word or two about that already. We know today that the universe appears to be expanding. As far out as we can see into space, the galaxies are moving away from one another. It is possible that if you could see out 50 times further, the galaxies wouldn't be moving apart from one another. But we can't see out that far. It's equally possible they're moving far apart faster out there or something else, okay? We've got to operate on the basis of the information we've got. The information we've got is that the universe seems to be expanding. We also, as we examine the universe, seem to see that as we look at the behavior of physical and chemical phenomena, we have something called entropy going on. A tendency for order to go disorder. A tendency for concentrations of energy to become scattered. This sort of situation. We also see functioning gravity as one of the very important forces in the universe. And in fact, a force which seems to overcome all other forces when matter is put together in sufficient densities. Even though some other forces, such as the strong interaction, are innately stronger forces. And we seem to see a phenomenon which goes by the name of relativity that tells us something about maximum speeds, tells us something about curvature of space, and some of these other sorts of things. Taking all of this material together, it appears that we are in a universe which had a beginning at a finite time in the past. The universe seems to be expanding. It seems to be running down. As you go back into the past, you would have it in a more condensed state and would apparently go back to a time in the past somewhere between 15 and 20 billion years ago where the universe was very concentrated. We seem to have the remains of the radiation from that concentrated state called the Big Bang around us. There have been attempts to avoid a beginning by saying the universe was once contracting before that expansion, kind of like an accordion. The universe collapses, bounces, collapses, bounces, perhaps every 100 billion years, things of that sort. However, it's a rather serious problem there. One problem is that it does not look like a collapsing universe would ever expand. What we know about the physical laws of the universe, if you get enough matter together in small enough space, gravity overpowers all other forces, and it pulls the stuff into a black hole. And you wouldn't ever get an expansion. Well, we're not in a black hole. I know a number of experiments you can do to check that. And therefore, it would appear that the expansion we see is something that expanded from a very concentrated state, but did not represent a collapsing state before that time. Jastrow has even a rather interesting little quirk to this. He says, suppose you imagine that there was a powerful enough force that it would blow the universe apart when the universe got very close together. Then he calculates the energy of this force, and by Einstein's special theory of relativity, he converts the energy to mass, and he shows that that mass would be sufficiently increase the total mass of the universe that instead of blowing itself apart, it would pull itself into a black hole. And therefore, no matter what force you add, the mass equivalent of the energy involved in that force would increase the total mass of the thing so that the gravitational force would overcome all the other forces and pull it in the black hole. He thinks there's no way out of that. One can, of course, say, well, general relativity, special relativity, you're not quite right. There's some way to get around it out here, but we've never found out how to do that yet. And wait and see, we will. You can, of course, do that with any evidence whatever. And certainly God could say at the last judgment, you've been suppressing the truth because you didn't follow where it went at the time you were living to make the decision. Here, then, is evidence, again, for an origin and for an originator. An originator does not necessarily require that the originator be the God of the Bible, but is consistent with the God of the Bible and is not consistent with a universe in which there's no God. There's another rather interesting area in relation to cosmology, and that is that we're beginning to put together some ideas on how the solar system came to be. How the collapse of the nebula, gas and dust, produced the sun and the planets, things of this sort. What's rather interesting, something first noticed, I believe, by Herman Eppelmann, is that there's a very close fit between the details of such theories and the details of Genesis chapter 1. He and I were collaborating in putting together a little book on this subject, which I'd recommend to you sometime if you think the first chapter of Genesis is just a bunch of guesses by primitive men of how things ought to have started. Genesis 1 and the origin of the earth. That, I think, suggests rather strongly something was known by the writer of the Bible that we cannot find historically was known by other cultures in antiquity. It suggests that the one who put the universe together has come into it and delivered information so that we can find out something about him. This is seen even more clearly in another line of evidence for the existence of God, which we call fulfillment of prophecy. You see, the Bible claims that the God who exists has got control of history. Though it appears he is standing back and is not as obvious as he might be, in fact, he is letting occur only those events which will subserve the plan that he has got for how things are going to go. He does it in such a way that men retain their moral responsibility. They do things with wicked motivations, they're responsible for it. They do things with good motivations, they are praised for it. But however they do it, God controls what actually happens, and everything is going to work out his way. He's got complete control of the universe, though it looks like he's not doing anything at first. Well, he claims, God does, at least God as pictured in the Bible claims, to be able to give evidence of this by telling you in advance things that are going to happen. There are some excellent examples in the Bible of this sort. In fact, there have been a number of books written on the subject. A book by Peter Stoner called Science Speaks has two chapters on examples of biblical passages written hundreds of years before the time of Christ and fulfilled at or after the time of Jesus. Also an excellent work on that subject, John Urquhart, Wonders of Prophecy. Good compilation of this material, not as much discussion, found in Josh McDowell's work, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And then a scholar by the name of J. Barton Payne has tried to look at every biblical prophecy and suggest which ones are still future, which ones have been fulfilled at various times in the past. His work is called Encyclopedia of Biblical Prophecy. Let me give you very quick, snappy, just two or three examples in this direction. The Bible makes rather explicit predictions about the fate of important nations existing during the time of Israel's history. For instance, in Ezekiel chapter 29, we are told that the nation of Egypt, which had been one of the world powers for over 2,000 years at Ezekiel's time, was going to become a downtrodden nation and would be downtrodden for centuries and would never be a great world power again. It's very striking to see that right at that time, the Persians, well, first the Babylonians, came in and damaged the Egyptians rather substantially, and then a century later, the Persians came through and took over Egypt. Egypt has never been a strong, independent nation since that time. It's been not even independent most of the time until the time here of Nasser, just in our century, and it has not been one of the leading powers even since that time. So for over 2,500 years since Ezekiel's time, Egypt has been a downtrodden nation. For 2,000 years before that time, Israel was one of the two or three leading nations in the civilized world. Predicted in Ezekiel. And whatever you think about the date of Ezekiel, Ezekiel could not very well, by writing after the event, point out that it would stay downtrodden all that length of time. Egypt has some very great natural advantages that many of the other nations around did not have, but have not been able to make it even with those in the time since. Another prophecy we see in the 13th chapter of the book of Isaiah is that the nation of Babylon, the city of Babylon, the city-state of Babylon, would be desolated forever. The desolation of Babylon does not occur right away after Isaiah writes, but is actually a rather gradual disaster that comes upon the nation. There are invasions, and they weaken the nation, and gradually it becomes less important. Then the Euphrates River moves. And when Babylon was on the Euphrates River, although it was out in the middle of what would otherwise be a desert, there was all this water available for irrigation. The Euphrates River moves 20 miles, and it's 20 miles out in the desert. It remains out there in the desert today, a place that no one inhabits, and yet it fits very well the picture of Isaiah chapter 13. Even more striking is a picture of the city-state Tyre, a rather important trading city on the Mediterranean coast, connected with the Phoenicians, was one of their major cities. Phoenicians, you understand, were one of the major trading nations of the ancient world. They were a group that, even before the time of the Greek Golden Age, had circumnavigated the end of South Africa, had gone down the Red Sea, down the east coast of Africa, around, I'm going the wrong way for your view, down the east coast, under the Cape of Good Hope, and back up around the other side. This is reported by one of the Greek authors, and he says, I don't believe it. And one of the reasons I don't believe it is a stupid remark they make. They say the sun was on the right side of them as they went around the Cape. And everyone knows that the sun is south of you, it's not north of you. They obviously made a foolish mistake. Well, if you dig out a globe today, you can see why the sun would have been on the right side, and it's hard to see how someone could have invented that in ancient times. They apparently really did go around the Cape. Tyre was one of the central cities. It was probably the most important of the eastern cities of the Phoenician Empire. And yet in Ezekiel 26, we are told that the mainland city of Tyre would be completely desolated. And more than that, that someone was going to take the ruins of the city of Tyre and push them into the sea and leave the site of Tyre a blank, empty, flat ground, just a bare rock. Leave no ruins of Tyre on the mainland. At the time this particular passage was written, Ezekiel written, a fellow by the name of Nebuchadnezzar was beating on the walls of Tyre. And he broke through and got in. And one might argue, well, the book of Ezekiel was written after he broke in or something of that sort. But Nebuchadnezzar did not clear the ruins. He just knocked the place over and tried to take what he could. Unfortunately for him, the inhabitants of Tyre had a little island about a half mile offshore, and so they retreated to the island, as many of them as could, and took all their goods with them, all their expensive goods with them. So when the guys broke in, they found broken pottery and beaten down houses and things like that, but didn't find any gold and silver they'd hoped for. It was all out on the island, and Nebuchadnezzar had no means of making an amphibious invasion. So he was left. He didn't have anything to pay his soldiers. They were irked, but they went down to Egypt and beat on that for a while and got back some pay. Anyway, 300 years later, Alexander the Great came through the East, and when he came to Tyre, he said, fellows, I'd like to worship your god Melkart. And you've got a nice temple there on the island. Let me come over and make a sacrifice. They kind of suspected if he came over, he wouldn't leave. So they said, hey, there used to be a perfectly good temple to Melkart over there on the coast. Why don't you worship there? That's a holy site, even if the temple's not much. And he decided they were not going to let him in. He decided he was going to make an example of the place. So he got together a navy from a couple of the cities he had conquered already and from the Greek homeland and began to attack them by sea. But he found that really didn't do much. You couldn't land enough people off a boat quick enough under the walls without getting messed up badly. So what he finally decided to do is the island was only a half mile offshore. He was going to build a roadway out to it. Well, he needed something to build it with. There were the ruins on the mainland city. He pushed all that stuff into the water, made a causeway out to the city, and by using then his naval attack from out there, building the causeway out and bring his army out the causeway, he was able to take the city of Tyre. But the result was, exactly as Ezekiel had predicted, the site of mainland Tyre was completely cleared, so it became bare rock, a place for fishermen to spread their nets. So we see in relation to, in these three examples, major nations of antiquity, detailed predictions of what was going to happen to them long before it happened. We see the same thing with the nation Israel, which of course is far more a subject of the Old Testament than are the other nations. In Hosea chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, we find out that the nation of Israel, though God had set up a government for it, had set up a king of the family of David for it, was going to be for a long time without any king. In fact, they would be without any government officials at all. And although the Israelites believed that God had appeared to them at Sinai and he had given them a detailed form of religion that involved high priests and temples and sacrifices, temple singular, and sacrifices, that there was going to come a time, according to Hosea, in which they would not have the high priest, they would not have the sacrifice. The religion that they understood had been given to them by God, but they wouldn't go into idolatry. What is striking is that is an excellent description of the status of the nation Israel from 70 AD, the destruction of the temple, until 1948 AD, at which point they have a government for the first time in nearly 2,000 years. They still don't have a temple, they still don't have a priesthood, although there are many in Israel would hope to set up something of that sort again. The biblical picture is that they will one day come back, they will one day turn to God, and presumably the implication is that these things, not having these, will be canceled out at that time. We have then not only here an example of something that is a rather detailed description of the status of a nation for a long time that exactly fits that nation, and nothing the nation would have gone out of its way to fulfill. You certainly don't go out of your way to destroy what you believe God has set up, to drive yourself into exile, to tear down what you understood to be the only way of atonement for sins. They, of course, after that developed a theology to explain how you could atone for sins without a priest and without a sacrifice, but they didn't have that until they had their temple gone. And yet we have a complete detailed film of this. And we have the restoration also predicted, which appears to be occurring today, although it's difficult, of course, to call the shots until you see what the shots are. So I won't climb too far out on that limb. Here then, detailed pictures of events that will happen among the nations, something that individuals could not have carried out, and yet they're detailed in fulfillment in Scripture. We have also a picture in Scripture of a deliverer who is to come one day, and he's called by many names in the Old Testament, but probably the one by which he's best known is Messiah. One who has been especially anointed by God to deliver Israel and to bring peace to the nations. It's interesting that there are several passages in the Old Testament which suggest that this person was to come in the first century A.D. There's a passage in Haggai chapter 2:9 where the prophet Haggai says, you see this temple we've just built? Looks pretty crummy, doesn't it? I'm paraphrasing slightly, you understand? No comparison to Solomon's temple. The glory of this temple will be greater than the glory of Solomon's temple. And by the way, that physically happened during the time of Herod, about starting about 20 BC and running out to 70 AD when it was destroyed. And it was here I will give peace. The picture here, God is going to do something spectacular that brings peace. And since the Messiah himself was known as Prince of Peace, the one who was to bring world peace, one might very well suggest that during the lifetime of that temple, the Messiah ought to come. And yet that temple was destroyed with the end of the Second Temple period in 70 AD. In Genesis chapter 49:10, we have, in a series of prophecies about the various tribes of Israel, a statement regarding the tribe of Judah. And it says of Judah, I better read it. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, unto him the gathering of the people, unto him the obedience of the people shall be. It's interesting. He says, the one to whom the scepter and the ruler's staff belong, he will come before the scepter and the ruler's staff depart from Judah. Now, first, one would say, that means the Messiah ought to have come before 587 B.C., because the descendants of David, who ruled over the tribe of Judah, stopped at that point. That is, they ceased to rule at that point. But something very interesting happens as you come down near the end of the Intertestament period, the Second Temple period, and that is another group of rulers begin to rule as Jewish kings over Judah. So in a slightly different sense of the word, in the first sense of the word, David kings were of the tribe of Judah. But the term Judah became applied to this nation, and a group of kings we call the Maccabees came to rule over the Jews in the land of Judea. That was, in fact, the Roman name. They ruled from, let's say, 140 B.C. to 63 B.C. And then their rule was interrupted. But then some fellows, who most Jews considered to be very suspicious, because they were made Jews by force and not by their own volition, groups called the Edomites, Edomians, a fellow in that racial background, who, however, claimed to be a true Jew, he became king of the Jews, and he ruled from 40 B.C., 37 actually, I think, he actually got control of the country, until 4 B.C., and he died. But then, a grandson of his became king of the Jews, and he ruled from 41 to 44 A.D., and then he died. There has been no Jewish king, no king over the Jews, since 44 A.D., The passage tells us here that the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor a ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. It would appear then that the one to whom it belongs, the Messiah, ought to have come before 44 A.D. Here we have, ought to have come before the destruction of Temple Jerusalem, ought to have come before 44 A.D. We have a third passage in Scripture that seems to point to a time of the Messiah's coming. That's found in Daniel chapter 9. Verses 24 through 27, where the events leading up to the cutting off of the anointed one, the prince, are supposed to take a period of 69 sevens of years, weeks of years, from a given starting point. If you work out the calculation, which I've done in another talk here at an earlier time, and you can probably dig up a cassette from the Faith Bible Church Library, the time period works out that this Messiah ought to have come between 28 and 35 A.D. It's rather interesting that one of the most striking persons in world history showed up in Judea just at that time. He made some claims that, as far as we know, Jews have never made before that time, and I don't think any of them made it afterwards. He not only claimed to be Messiah, that's happened many times. That happened with Simeon ben Kasiba, 135 A.D. That happened with a number of people in the medieval period. But this person claimed not only to be Messiah, but he claimed to be the very Son of God. He claimed to be, in fact, God himself, having become a man to appear, yet fits exactly in to this predicted time period. Well, here are a few examples of fulfillment prophecy. These suggest that not only does a God exist, as pointed out in the arguments of design and nature and cosmology, but this God has control of history. This God has demonstrated himself in the biblical scriptures, and this fellow, this God, manifested himself in a unique way in history with the coming of the Messiah, claiming to be God's son in 28, 35 AD. Those are the examples we'll look at this evening. There are the lines of evidence, and there's certainly a great deal more evidence in the area of fulfilled prophecy. I think that one can fairly say the evidence for the existence of God, the God of the Bible, is stronger than the evidence for the existence of any other God that has been proposed in our human history. I've not looked at all examples, but I've not seen anybody come forward comparable material. That's certainly far greater than the evidence for the non-existence of God. I don't claim that nobody can quibble with it, because the Bible allows men room to go their own way if they want to go that way, but to take the consequences. What I would say is the force of this evidence is sufficiently strong to convict anyone in any court of law. It is just at all. That a person who used the kind of quibbles you would have to use to get away from Christian evidence would be convicted in any court of law if he tried to use those for explaining why the light didn't really look red to him when he went through it, and various other things of that sort. That the argument is not beyond quibbling because of the silence of God and the sinfulness of men, but it is sufficient that men will have no valid excuse for not turning to the God of the Bible. I might mention one other feature here in conclusion, and that's what usually goes by the name of Pascal's wager. A French mathematician, professing Christian, perhaps a real Christian, named Pascal, pointed out a rather interesting feature of Christianity, and that is, Christianity believes that you only have one life, and when that's over, you don't get a chance to run it over again, or try again, or something of that variety. That Christianity's picture of what happens if you have chosen to ignore the God of the Bible is terrible. It's not something that I enjoy talking about at all. It's a terrible thing. It is suffering punishment continually. Forever, a terrible thing. Pascal's wager is this. If one is going to bet on what religion is right, it would be very dangerous to bet against a religion in which your loss would be an infinite loss if you're wrong. At minimum, you would want to take religions in which there's an infinite loss for being wrong and set them in a category by themselves and examine those. And while you're looking at that category, you can take out all of those where you get a second and third chance and put them over here and wait till your second and third chance to examine those. And look at those religions in which there's infinite loss for being wrong. You have only one chance, that is this life, to work it out right. And you should investigate those very carefully. One should at least, with such a danger being presented before them, be willing to spend a substantial amount of time all of their life to investigate such types of religions. I only know of one such religion, but there might be some others, and that's Christianity. But I'm not asking you to jump into Christianity without looking anywhere else. I'm trying to show you that indeed there's some real evidence for Christianity. I can't stop here without saying a word or two about the basic message of the Bible, the basic message from the God of the Bible, about what's this all about, and what do we need to do about it. It's what we call the good news, the gospel. However, it is preceded by what we call the bad news. The bad news is that we were made to love God with all our heart and mind and soul. We were made to love our neighbor as much as we love ourselves. The bad news is we don't do it. None of us does it. We're like a TV set that cost $1,000, and everything works except the picture. Doesn't do what it was made to do. Now we say, so what? But we don't say, so what? Anytime anybody else demonstrates that character to us, we get irked about it. Somebody cuts us off when we're driving. Somebody says something snide to us when we're trying to be nice to them. Somebody cheats us. We're mad about it. It's right that we should be mad about it too, because they have violated moral principles which we actually have inside us and which were not invented by us for our own convenience. We try to get them to disappear for our own convenience. They were something built into us that tell us something about how we'll be. We're all sinners, that's all the Bible says. We don't love God like we ought to. We don't love other people like we ought to. And if you really look at the world around us, and an awful lot of us think it's pretty much of a mess, you have to find out that the ecology problem is not really a problem with ecology. It's a problem with somebody's messing it up. Man. And the energy problem is not really a problem with lack of energy. It's a problem with somebody's using too much of it or not producing enough of it or something else. In fact, if you examine all the world problems, they turn out to be human problems. We're all sinners. And we don't like it when somebody sins against us. We don't worry about it too much when we sin against someone else. But in everything we do, we're sinning against God. He doesn't like it either. We're not the way we were made to be. We're not what we ought to be. And like a TV set that won't work, one is tempted to either send it back to the manufacturer or kick it. And in this particular case, the TV set is not working not because of fault of the manufacturer, but because of the fault of the operator, who happens to be the TV set himself in this case. Man, the operator, has messed up man, the equipment, and God, the maker, is not too happy about it. God is, in fact, going to punish. God is going to face us with judgment one day. He could face us with his own standards of judgment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul. You shall love your neighbors yourself. And if he did, none of us would pass. But he doesn't have to use that highest standard for none of us to pass. All he has to do is use the standards we use against each other. And none of us will pass. Take every moral statement we've ever made, rebuking other people. We may not have constructed them in moral form. We may have constructed them in the form of cursing them or making some angry statement, but it still conceals a moral judgment. Take every one of those and put it not when we said it, but beside when we did the same thing. And every one of us would come out a failure. God is going to punish. And he sent us this evidence that he exists, that we might know that while we've got a chance to do something about it. Because we do have a chance to do something about it. We have no way by pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps to become people who love God with all our heart and mind and soul, or even people who love our neighbors as ourselves. We can't do it. But God can change us. And he's got an arrangement to change us so that we will be able to do it. But God cares about righteousness too. He cares about the fact that we have already built up a terrible debt of not being what we ought to be. That we haven't done what we ought to have done. We have done what we oughtn't to do. God's concerned about that. God is not one of these people that can say, forget about it, because he's righteous as well as loving. Righteous as well as merciful. But he's done something by which he can be righteous, and he can also have mercy on people who can't help themselves. What did he do? God himself became a man, lived a life of complete righteousness, which we could not live. If we trust in Jesus Christ, the righteousness that he performed, which kept all of God's commandments, will be applied to our account as though we had done it. The death that he suffered in a few hours on the cross, but in which he was able to suffer something that would have taken us an infinity of time to suffer, if we trust in him, the punishment we deserve will have been taken by him. And more than that, it's not just a game where he says, all right, I count you righteous on the basis of what Jesus has done. Jesus has taken your punishment. I'm not going to do that for you, because we'd be left in a slight problem that we still continue to be the way we were. God has also made an arrangement to change that. If we trust in Jesus, God does something inside of us called the new birth, the new creation, etc. A change takes place in our outlook, and that begins to produce a change in our behavior. And that change in behavior is actually the only hope for the world, that men might be what they're made to be. All of the world problems we hear about are a result of what man is and what he ought not to be, and the solution to all of them in the long run is that man be made what he ought to be. God offers you right now, tonight, an opportunity to get straightened out with him. Trust in him, trust in Jesus Christ, your sins are paid for by him. Trust in Jesus Christ, your debt, the righteousness you owed has been paid by him. Trust in him, God will change you inside and begin a lifelong work of making you into the kind of person you ought to be.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.